Hello and welcome to Firestarter, the UK's first podcast for social enterprise in health. And this is this week is the first of a two-part interview with Adrian Ashton on the pros and cons of KICs, community interest companies. Hi, and this week's podcast we're having a chat with Adrian Ashton about community interest companies. Do you want to introduce yourself, Adrian?
Okay, I'm Adrian. There we go. That's it. I'm Adrian Ashton. I'm a young, relatively healthy 30-something living in the north of England. I've been doing stuff in what's called the third sector, social enterprise co-ops, for, I guess, about 12 years now. If you want any more boring background stuff about my shoe sizes or preferences, you just Google me and be surprised what comes up.
Actually, you should give your web address. It's a good website, actually.
All the W's with a dot, Adrian Ashton, and a dot, and co.uk.
Cool. All right. Well, one of the things I thought we'd have a natter about is community interest companies, and basically kind of the pros and cons and sort of what works and what doesn't work and what your thoughts are, really. I mean, is it worth a kind of idiot's guide to people on what they are?
Okay, yeah. What I think it might be useful to do as well is give a bit of background to where how they came into being, as I see it. Right. It's probably worth saying at this point that I'm not a technically qualified lawyer, but I have challenged company
that's
law.
That's your disclaimer.
That's my disclaimer. Actually, it's worth saying, in respect of community interest companies and organisations thinking of adopting this status, because it is a status, it's not a specific independent legal form of its own. Whatever legal form or legal status you choose to adopt, you have to choose it yourself.
Yeah.
You shouldn't. I always say this, if all the lectures and training I give to people like legal structures, legal forms, governance arrangements, whatever, is if you remember nothing else, remember that you should never, ever pick your legal form on the basis that someone else says that's what you should be.
Which really does my head in. I've the number of conversations where people ring me up and go, I want to be a KIC, can you help me with the memorandum and articles? And I'm going, why do you want to be a KIC? Oh, I spoke to a lawyer and they told me. I'm like, whoa, you know, this is just... But a lot of people do.
Yes,
you know.
Because there's been a lot of hype. There's been a lot of sound bites because it's the KICs are the first new legal model on statute books in over a century. Now, that's quite exciting for anoraks like me who do things like read the Companies Act 2006 and get excited by it.
And it's worth just telling people as well, because you're going to hear some really interesting background noises. We're in a cafe. We should get a plug, actually. This is a fantastic cafe in Todmorden called Cafe 72, which is the most child-friendly cafe I've ever been in. So you're going to hear people wandering in. You'll hear kids. You'll hear bits of background noise. And
cappuccino machines hissing.
Cappuccino. And a fantastic resident artist.
Yes.
I think we can plug.
Yes. So I don't think we'll say her name, though.
No, we won't.
It might be too much of a plug.
Yeah. So, sorry. We were talking about...
So, yeah. KICs. So, yeah, we've put the disclaimers in to say if you can never come back and sue us for libel or slander.
Yeah,
so KICs, KICs are exciting because they're the most visible, tangible thing that the state has done for social enterprise ever, frankly.
Right.
In living memory, anyway.
Okay.
The government has said, we're going to create something new and special just for social enterprise. And that's quite exciting. Lots of people get excited by that because it's a bigger impact than funding because funding programs come and go.
Yeah.
They've effectively changed the laws to accommodate social enterprise. Where it's come from, as I understand, okay, back in 2000-ish, maybe 2001, what was the DTI, now the Department for Education, Business Regulation and Reform, or something like that, produced a strategy called the Government's Strategy for Social Enterprise. In it, they said, the government think social enterprises are cool and sexy and groovy, and they can be even cooler and sexy and groovy and do lots of cool and groovy things if the following things are enacted.
Right. And one of them was the legal structure.
One of them was actually not a legal structure. One of them was about a better recognition in the marketplace.
Okay.
The idea that you can have a badge. So just as, for example, you can have investors in people.
Yeah.
So if you're trading with another company in the marketplace and you say, one of my criteria for trading with you is I want to be trading with a responsible employer. They've got investors in people, and I'm trading with a responsible employer.
So I recognise,
And what we've started to see recently from stuff down in the southwest is a social enterprise kite mark.
Right.
Social Firms UK piloted one last year in 2007, but at that time there was no badge, there was no kite mark.
Because 4 or 5 years ago, and certainly when I set up my first social enterprise, the European Nursing Leadership Foundation, there was basically a company into my guarantee, company into my shares, co-op, registered charity.
Okay.
there was probably another one, but there was the, but that was pretty much. Then we went down company limited by guarantee because a lot of the organisations that, that seemed to be doing the sort of thing we were doing, that was their legal structure.
Yeah, and generally speaking, if you're not sure what form you should adopt,
yeah,
I would always say to people as a default position, take a company limited by guarantee.
Yeah,
because it's the easiest to set up, the cheapest to set up, and the easiest to change if you need to in the future.
Yeah. Although, what we then discovered after year two, I think, is you can't change a company limited by guarantee into a company limited by shares. Or companies have said we couldn't, and we approached lawyers and they said we couldn't. And it was interesting that we had some odd discussions, a bit of a tangent, some really odd discussions with bank managers in the early days when they went, who owns the company? And I went, nobody owns the company. Companies limited by guarantees are not owned.
It belongs to its members.
Yeah, and it really threw them to go, well, where's the share capital? Well, there isn't any. Right.
Yeah. Because most of the financial institutions, most of the professional services industries for enterprise, social or otherwise, are geared up to private sector businesses.
Yeah.
Where the rule of norm is public limited company or limited by share.
Yeah.
And then you go to them saying, we're a limited liability partnership. We're an industrial provenance society. And they go, what the heck is that?
So that's where company and trust companies sort of came from. So
what... going back a few, that's safe because I only just mentioned about the badge and then we got onto to tangents. So this social enterprise strategy said one of the things we want to see is a badge. And so various national membership bodies at that time started to look at the idea, come up with a checklist and a framework, which isn't widely known because they didn't want to risk it if they went wrong. What came out after looking at it for a year or two was saying social enterprise is too complex, it's too diverse, it's too colourful. We can't easily narrow it down to like two or three tick boxes with an evidence base like you can for investors and people.
Yeah.
So we went back to government. And around that time, there were a couple of solicitors down in London somewhere, probably in an oyster bar or wine bar, knocking about the idea of what was to become the community interest company.
Okay.
In terms of the framework. I think they originally wanted to call it the community benefit society or the community benefit companies. But anyway, so they used their links. The timing of it, things were coming together separately, and it all seemed to coalesce at this one point. For some reason, the Treasury took the lead on it.
Right.
Now, at that time, the Treasury was under the leadership of Gordon Brown, and we say and we refer what we want from that, but anyway.
We can say what we want. He's probably listening to us saying.
Yeah. His aides will be listening to us.
Yeah.
Anyway. So those consultations went out, and this idea was born, the Community Interest Company, which at that time said... To be a community interest company, it's a bolt-on, so you have to have a company format behind it.
Yeah.
By guarantee or by share, and then you have to prove you're going to benefit the community. Mm. So through all these consultation periods, I went to some of them and I said, well, what defines the community? Mm. Yeah, what is it? And they said, at that time the response was saying, there has to be a definable community.
So let's just, it kind of went live about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Two-ish years ago. So would it be useful just to kind of very quickly establish kind of what a community interest company is?
Yes.
So there are, so as you were saying, it's a company.
Yep, of some type.
And 90% of it is the same as
an ordinary company.
Yeah.
The extra bits in it...
Then it can be limited by guarantee and limited by shares, which my idiot guide way of saying it is shares mean you've got equity which you can then sell to other people, sell to the public, raise finances and stuff through,
or pay yourself bonus
ownership. Yeah,
this idea of sweat equity.
Yeah,
a lot of people will go months and months working in social enterprise setting up without drawing a salary.
Yeah,
for the love of
it. It's actually very common.
Very common. If you're doing it in the private sector, you would get paid for it at a future date through share dividend.
Yeah,
why don't we do it for ourselves?
Yeah,
it just doesn't have to be extortion. There has to be a way to recognise and to limit that. The KIC allows that to happen because the KIC says, if you are company limited by share, there's a cap on how much profit you can distribute by share dividend.
Yeah.
So no more than a third, generally speaking.
So the first thing I often say to people is if KIC is the right model, there are two flavours of KIC. And often I'll start, I don't know about you, but often start the conversation of if you're going down a company model and you've got four models, company limited by guaranteed company shares, KIC limited by guaranteed KIC company shares, let's discuss shares or not shares first, then work out what flavour. Because sometimes people go down a KIC model and haven't even had that thought about the shares, the relationship between the members and the board. And so.
Interestingly, the reason why, because there was a lot of discussion around should KICs be open to companies limited by shares?
Okay.
Because about 10 years ago, the sector as it was emerging was very opposed to the ideas of company limited by shares.
Yeah.
Because of the potential you could take out private profit, personal profit for private gain by share dividend.
Yeah.
Without any repercussion. But there's
and some of the worst excesses of the city seem to be driven by shareholders going down and maximising money.
So because the way the kicks come about, and it said there's a cap on share dividend, therefore that makes it safe.
Yeah.
Therefore, all of a sudden, companies limited by shares are politically acceptable for social enterprise.
Yeah,
that's fine. So in terms of the features of the features of the kick, you have to prove that there's an identifiable community.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, there was a test case about 18 months ago. A very colourful test case, and if anybody wants to know the nature of the business, there may be children listening, so I'm not going to mention their type of activity.
Oh, it's the S&M.
The Smarties and Maltesers Club.
Yeah. If there are children listening to a social enterprise podcast, by the way, you just need to go and play on an Xbox or a PlayStation. This is bad.
But that's an interesting test case, because what it meant was that at the time, they were able to fulfil the criteria to being a kick because they had an identifiable community of interest.
Yeah.
Not a community of area, community of kind. What the regulator said was, actually, we think we're going to look at the rules again. Actually, what we think to be what is meant by the legislation is it's a community of area, a geographical community. So therefore, dear applicant, you can still progress your application, but you're going to have to broaden your community, the community you're going to benefit. So it's people who partake of certain recreation activities living in a certain area.
Oh, now that's interesting, because entrepreneurs' community hasn't got a geographic area.
It will probably be assumed, therefore, that your geographical area is England.
Oh, right.
Because I had this discussion with the initial regulator, John Hanlon, at a conference to try and specify this.
Okay.
And he made it clear at the an open conference a couple of years ago, which was during his last year as a regulator, that you had to show it was a community of area.
Right.
You can have different groups within that, but principally it's about a community of area.
And I think that's one of the areas where I think one of the areas of social enterprise is registered charities, voluntary groups moving into a social enterprise model. And some of them struggle with the community model because they've got aims and objectives. And you go, but there's a difference between aims and objectives. And what is your community? And I know some people that sort of struggle, you know, that they kind of want to, well, we want everyone to be happier, or, you know, we want to alleviate poverty. But what does that mean? Who's going to be?
Yeah. Mm. Now, within a kick, that actually can be a useful thing, because it forces you as an organisation, it forces your governance body to actually focus on what it is you're doing.
Yeah.
To be more specific, to better focus your energies, to better allocate your resources, a better impact.
And once a year, you've got to do a report on what you've done for that community.
Once a year, just as with the charity, you have to make a report that says, this is what we've set up to do, this is what we've done to achieve it.
Okay.
There you go. Now, the interesting thing is about a kicks, in terms of the still talking about features of kicks. So this idea of the community benefit.
Yeah.
This idea that if you're a share company, there's a limit on how much profit you can distribute by share dividend.
Yeah.
So the majority of it is retained for the benefit of the community. If the company borrows money, there's a limit on how much interest you're allowed to pay. Mm. And also this idea of the asset lock.
Yeah.
So, again, a common feature of any social enterprise you'll see somewhere is an asset lock. If the company's wound up or dissolved and it still owns money or assets, they have to be used to further the social purposes it was set up to deliver. They can't just be taken off by future membership because it's got lots of money.
And that's a really interesting, because charities often have that. And I think
charities have to have it by law.
Yeah, and a lot of people, I don't know if the word had been used that much around charities, but suddenly you will hear asset lock, and it kind of gives a guarantee to people that says, well, if you're going to contract with a kick or a registered charity, you know that the owners can't just take squillions of quid out of the company and put it in their back pockets.
Now, there is interesting, again, this is one of those issues where I often talk about spirit of the law and letter of the law and how you can work around them. Now, I make no moral judgments on how people want to work, play with the rules or play around them. I simply want to make sure they know the options.
Yeah.
So that how they choose to implement this up to them, because they have to sleep with their consciences at night. But I want to make sure people are fully versed as to what they can and what they might be able to do, or what other people are doing. So there were a lot of kicks starting up where the kicks don't own the assets. The assets are on loan to them or leased to them by people who are members or directors.
Oh, I haven't come across one of those.
So I've come across a few of those.
Right.
Now,
is that to get around the asset lot?
Yeah.
Right.
So therefore, if the kick is dissolved, the kick doesn't own the asset.
Right.
That has various benefits to the kick and the individual. To the kick, it means it doesn't have to go through a lengthy process of raising finance to get the asset. It gets instant access to the asset, a flexible access. It gets it on friendly terms, usually.
Okay.
To the person who owns the asset, there's a degree of protection that says, well, I'm investing my asset in the kick that I'm part of.
Yeah.
But if the worst thing happens, I'm not going to lose out.
Yeah.
Because it's still mine in law. I'm just leasing it at a nominal rate.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So that's an option that a lot of people look at. But yeah, the asset lock is not unique. Okay. A lot of people say, oh, you have to have a kick if you want an asset lock. An asset lock can be put into any legal structure, and even a PLC.
And interesting, that's one of the things I've said to people when they go, oh, a big attraction for a kick is an asset lock. I said, well, put it in your memorandum and articles of a limited company.
And you can entrench it. Technically speaking, it's if an asset lock is in a kick or a charity, it's protected by statute.
Yeah.
The government have guaranteed that asset lock can't be changed. If you put it into a company or a society or something else as an optional extra, which you can do, I've done it with lots of people, and then you put another clause in that says you can change any rule apart from this asset lock, the only way you can actually change that rule then is to go to a court hearing or something like that. So it's a very long-winded come. But it can technically be done,
but
it's not worth the hassle.
Absolutely.
Not worth the hassle. So it's not unique. The kick is sold on this asset lock, but it's not unique.
So,
sorry, the other thing on the asset lock, it's the most bureaucratic one. In your rules as a kick, you have to specify the name of the kick or the charity who will inherit the asset should you be dissolved.
Yeah, which
it's the only form you have to do that in.
Which is really interesting, because I've not actually told the charity that I've named, and I thought it would be a surprise if all, you know, we wind up. But yeah, it's odd that you have to say, and you have to give the number and the charity, and you know. So what are the kind of... well, let's cover the pros first, because I think one of the interesting things, and one of the conversations Adrian often do is a lot of people talk about kicks as if there are no drawbacks, and actually there are some cons and some real issues. But let's quickly talk about
what's
the pros
great about
first.
Kick?
Yeah,
visibility.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of hype, a lot of media surrounding them.
It associates you with social enterprise very clearly.
It does. Now, what I've become aware of over the last year or so is that if you are dealing with public sector commissioning officers, particularly in health, if you say you're a kick, you're straight in the door. You know, you've gone around the open, it gets you, it kind of shortcuts you through the opening preliminaries. Mm. You don't have to establish your credentials, it's there. For those kicks, though, who have, so it's a very strong brand within certain markets.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a reassurance. So, you know, so if you're setting yourself up, you've got a reassurance that you've got these protections. So if you want to attract people to join you as directors, members, employees, they're seeing that they're signing up to something which is very rigid, very formal, very well regulated and protected. It's also very sexy in certain circles, you know, so it's something new, you know, that I see people wanting to buy the new iPod notepad because it's only like 3 millimeters thick.
I know.
I suspect it will still be a computer. It will do the job, but some people are salivating at the thought of having it because it's new and sexy. They're the innovators.
Don't buy it, ladies and gentlemen, but that's the subject of another podcast.
So for the innovators out
there. I'm sticking with my MacBook.
So for the innovators.
It's a sexy, and there were a lot of, there was an interesting rush for the first people to go, and you thought, yeah, those people that want to be on the cutting edge. And...
Yeah, so that part of being something new and exciting, and all that comes with it. To my mind, those are the pros.
There's another quick one, I think they're an interesting regulator. These things change over time, but having dealt with certainly the Charity Commission, the kick's actually helpful. If you ring them and go, I want to be a kick, you're likely to have quite long conversations. Mm. They'll send you lots of information. You can download model memorandum and articles, which are actually very... When I did on my first social enterprise, I couldn't afford a lawyer. We cobbled it together off the web. And in fact, people then looked at it and went, this looks interesting. It's copy-paste and tweet. Whereas they've got...
Long as no one said, this looks really familiar. Let me just check my copy.
Yeah, you've nicked that off us. And they actually give you model memorandum articles, tell you what to put in, what to... So it's a nice... I think they're quite encouraging. It's like, if you want to be a kick, we'll encourage you, we'll try and help you. Yep. If you've got any problems, give us a ring. So that's good.
They're also, as a regulator, they're also very open-minded.
Yeah.
It's probably worth saying at this point that a couple of years... Was it about a year ago, 18 months ago? I publicly challenged the kick regulator over some of the clauses that you have to have on various grounds, which we may or may not get to. Yeah. If we don't, the whole debacle's on my website under the articles heading.
AdrianAshton.co.uk.
Oblique articles. Yeah. So the letters, the things I had published, the letters I wrote, the responses from the regulator themselves, and the blogs that people started as a result.
Brilliant. But let's get on to the cons, because a lot of people are hyping up the pros.
Yes.
And actually very, very few people are talking about the cons.
Absolutely. And for me, and again, this comes back to the early point I made about saying you should never pick your legal structure on the basis that someone tells you that's what you should do.
That's the only thing you remember from this podcast.
Yeah.
Do not do and just what a lawyer says. Any lawyer who tells you there is one model is an idiot. Get a better lawyer.
And interestingly, the first kick became a kick on the basis that a local funding officer told them that's what they should be.
I didn't know.
And they became a kick. And there we go. That's an interesting sign. So there are some cons.
Okay.
Namely, you have, because it's a bolt-on, it's a status to an existing legal form, to company, you've got an extra layer of bureaucracy, an extra layer of reporting and monitoring and evaluation.
Because you've got to do all the company's house stuff.
And then all the kick regulator stuff.
And all the kick regulator stuff, yeah.
Now, if you're being open and transparent and wanting to be, you'll probably be reporting what you're doing anyway as a company. So, maybe it kicks useful in that respect because it gives you a framework to do it to. But there are clauses you have to adopt. Within a kick. Now, this is where I personally have reservations, but I stress personally because, to my mind, I have difficulty reconciling them with what social enterprises are set up to do, particularly certain types of social enterprise, but I've helped people become kicks.
Yeah.
So my approach is generally, just because I don't like it doesn't mean it's not right for everyone. As long as I'm
you're going with your eyes wide open. Yeah. So there are pros, there are cons, and I think there are pros and cons with all of them. I think you can make any legal model work. There is no perfect legal model. I said it's basically trade-offs depending on what you want to do and why you're doing it and your membership. Okay, so what's the first?
So one of them is about, it's probably stressed, the context for these concerns is about values.
Right.
And the relationship between social enterprises and co-ops. Social enterprises are seen by many now as coming out of the cooperative movement.
Right.
Historically. Now, that's probably a whole podcast series to be had, but it's starting to become more accepted. Mm. And there are various reasons around that. If you want to talk to me about that separately, that's fine.
I think we might, because interestingly, I'm picking up a lot of, particularly around medical cooperatives.
Okay.
The NHS is quite interested, and it actually has a bit of a track record in co-op.
I spoke at a national conference a couple of years ago about the relationship between the two sectors.
Okay.
And it was the one breakout session that was massively oversubscribed. I had people piling in the corridors to come to hear.
Yeah.
So co-ops, and there's a parallel here between co-ops and social enterprise. Social enterprise has no legal definition.
Yes.
Co-ops have no legal definition in this country.
Oh, right, I didn't know.
Okay.
Because an industrial provident site is a type of co-op, but there's other ones, aren't there?
But you can structure a co-op as a society, as a company.
Right, okay.
There are arguments that some people make that say you can do it as a charity. Very dubious, but anyway. So how do you recognise a co-op then, if there's no legal definition? You recognise it by its values and how its values are enacted.
Okay.
There's no legal definition for social enterprise. How do you recognise a social enterprise then? By its values and how they're enacted, which means values are so important. Mm. And your legal form should represent and show what your values are and how they're protected and enacted. Now, interestingly, one of the downsides to a kick as well, in terms of before we go into the small print, is quite a broad brush pillar. One of the defining characteristics of social enterprise in the early days, around the year 2000, used to be community ownership.
Yeah.
That the community you set up to represent or benefit had ownership. Now, if that was, if it was a social enterprise to benefit Todmorden, where we are now, a cafe in 72 opposite the park, plug.
It's a really nice cafe.
That would
as well.
Be very competitively priced. Great range of food and drink. There would be residents, local businesses, local involved in the governance and the membership of the organisation. In order to protect that social enterprise's mission, its vision, its values. With a kick, there's no requirement for that community you've set up to benefit to have any contact or involvement with you.
Yeah.
They don't have to be a membership, you don't have to consult with them, you just simply have to do nice things for them.
Yeah.
I think this is probably where a lot of the draconian stuff, as I see it, has come from.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to protect those communities, because the danger is you have a lot of kicks now starting up, one or two people, the social entrepreneurs, the family businesses who are becoming kicks, and haven't got a line of accountability to their community formally. So that's why the regulator is so potentially has a lot of power. So the regulator says, sometimes we think about values again, the regulator says the chair has to have a second vote.
Which is really odd. I mean, that's kind of almost unique in any other legal model that says the chair votes and the chair gets a second vote. And it's not one of those where the board can go... Because I've known boards where they go, the chair won't vote, but if there's a tie, he does casting.
Now, interestingly enough, within kick model rules as well, kick model rules say decisions have to be based unanimously. collectively. So why should the chair have this second vote?
Yeah.
If it, now, what's come back through my discussions with the regulators and others has been this issue of saying, well, in any, it's a business.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to make tough decisions. Those decisions may cause a polarisation of view and opinion. Sometimes you have to force a decision through. Otherwise, you get stuck. Yeah. You lose the opportunity and the business dies. So we need to be able to, so if it gets to a deadlock, we have to be able to make a call either way.
But the interesting thing is, and I can see the logic of let's take it from a business perspective, but chairs having second votes is rare in a business board.
It is. It's the also, the kick is the only legal model where it's mandatory.
Yeah.
Every other legal model that exists, it's optional.
Optional. Yeah.
Now, my concern with that is based on a first-hand experience I had with a big social enterprise, big open meeting. An issue came to a vote with all in front of all the members, and it was a hung vote amongst the board. Chair took the second vote, and the chair voted the other way to his first vote.
What?
Which caused absolute pandemonium and uproar. But anyway,
okay.
So that's me concern. You know, and so there's a concern to say, well, how fair and just is it that one person who just happens to be chair that day,
because
you could be chair by accident, should have more power than anyone else?
Yeah.
And what safeguard is there to stop them doing something bonkers like that? There's also, in terms of broader governance issues, if an issue is so polarised that it's effectively split your board and you force it through, you risk losing half your board and the fallout from that. Oh, the music started in the background, so we have a soundtrack to the podcast now.
And this isn't Creative Commons, so we'll just have to blag our way through this.
So there's that part of it. We also have the issue of alternate directors. Now, this is not uncommon for social enterprises or others. The idea of alternate directors is saying, if you can't get to a meeting, you can instruct someone else to vote on your behalf.
Yeah.
That's fine. What I have a concern about within that is that it's not optional.
Yeah.
So again, this idea of, you know, some of the values about self-empowerment, self-responsibility, taking responsibility. If you are saying to someone else, oh, I can't be bothered to go, you vote on my behalf. So, you know, Dave, on my say, you've been co-opted onto the board.
Right.
And I can't make it to this next meeting, so you just take my vote on the issues, because you know what, I think that's fine.
Yeah.
You can use my vote whatever way you want to.
Right.
And there's no safeguard against that, really.
Yeah.
So much better, surely, to have some kind of proxy voting system of a written proxy. Because if a board is functioning properly...
Let's just pause this, I'm just going to see if I can get the volume down a smidge.
And that was the end of part one's interview with Adrian Ashton, and part two will be next week. Well, thank you for listening. This was Firestarter, the UK's first podcast for social enterprises in health. And you can find more on our website at entrepreneurses.net. That's entrepreneurses.net. My name's been Dave Dawes, and the music's Fire Dance by DJ Booley through a Creative Commons license, which you can find out more on the website. Hope to see you next week. Bye.